This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Healing Process. This is Lecture 5, entitled Medicine and Anthroposophical Insight into the Human Being, Number 1, given in The Hague on November 15, 1923. Above all, I would like to thank Dr. Zeilmans and all of you for giving me the opportunity to speak on the consequences of the anthroposophical research method in the field of medicine. Footnote, Willem Zeilmans van Emmerichoven, 1893-1961, a physician in the Netherlands who headed his own clinic, and a footnote. In two short lectures, I will not be able to provide more than a few indications, of course. My perspective deviates significantly from conventional contemporary views, and much of what I have to say will necessarily sound paradoxical at best. It will be especially difficult to overcome these obstacles and move on in two brief sessions. But as you know, ladies and gentlemen, we have learned to adjust our thinking on many questions in the course of humanity's historical development, which suggests that forbearance is in order, at least initially, when a perspective that results from truly conscientious research appears paradoxical. First of all, I would like to say by way of introduction that my purpose in presenting the medical consequences of anthroposophical research is not to introduce brand new ideas that will contradict the very thorough discipline of modern medicine, which is based on centuries of scientific precedent. The method of research I will describe here has no desire to overthrow modern medicine. On the contrary, it simply explores some of the recent results of the rigorous, sense-based empirical methods that science has inherited from the natural sciences, and the great scope of the questions that arise, and concludes that modern medicine is heading in a direction that it will find difficult to maintain, simply because its well-known, sense-based, empirical research methods are so very conscientious and precise. The same factors that made science great and provided such significant foundations for medicine have also made it possible to pursue certain ways of understanding the human being and human medicine. For this reason, please allow me to first present a few general principles today. Tomorrow I will discuss the unusual qualities of a few typical anthroposophical remedies. We anthroposophists did not choose a propagandistic approach, deciding that anthroposophy must know something about everything and must therefore also take a position on medicine. Those of us who are firmly rooted in anthroposophy choose to take a truly scientific approach, at least as far as our fundamental principles are concerned. The medical movement within the general anthroposophical movement came about when some physicians, especially in Germany but also in other countries, realized that modern science and medicine raise questions that conventional methods cannot answer, at least not to the extent of providing a direct and rational connection between diagnosis and treatment. These physicians approached me and asked whether anthroposophy might contribute to the field of medicine by providing more penetrating insights into the human constitution than are possible using conventional methods. Footnote, Rudolf Steiner responded to these questions in his first lecture course for physicians, titled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine, Collected Works, Volume 312. End of footnote. Thus, what I tell you today and tomorrow has been made possible by the requests of these physicians, whose individual studies and practice had left them unsatisfied, or at least somewhat skeptical. From the very beginning, we certainly did not assume that we could feel free to make all kinds of amateurish contributions to a rigorous field of research and its practical applications. When the founders of the Commendatag in Stuttgart and the Futurum in Switzerland advised us to support medical research, I insisted that although anthroposophy could indeed shed light on the preparation of remedies, we should not limit ourselves to that activity, and that all such efforts should be as closely associated as possible with the actual practice of medicine. Footnote, Der Kommendetag, which means the coming day, was established in Stuttgart in 1920 as a joint stock company to promote economic and spiritual values, an association in the spirit of the threefold nature of society, as described by Steiner's social works. It had to be liquidated in 1925 because of the severity of inflation. Futurum AG was an economic society to promote international economic and social values. It was established in Dornach in 1920 to be similar to the Kommendetag. It did not survive the financial crisis of the time and had to be liquidated in 1924. End of footnote. This was the origin of our institutes, which not only manufacture remedies according to the methods I am going to describe, but also are associated with clinics. Footnote, see footnote page 16, end of footnote. In the further course of these lectures, I will have occasion to speak about these clinics, especially the exemplary one in Arlesheim, which is headed by Dr. Ita Wegman and is directly associated with our anthroposophical facility for higher education, the Goetheanum in Switzerland. Daily interaction with patients in these clinics gives our anthroposophical medical research a vital connection to actual therapy, which we see as the most significant issue of our time. Not content with simply establishing these pharmaceutical and clinical facilities, we have also linked them to other research institutes, including an institute for biology and several institutes for physics. I will not say more about the physics institutes at this point, because they are still in the very early stages of their work. The Institute for Biological Research, however, has already produced two studies, footnote, see footnote page 23, end of footnote. I mention them to show you that we intend to work with the same degree of precision that is demanded of other scientists. It is a matter of honest conviction, rather than foolish vanity, when I say, and the results themselves will convince you, that in spite of the few objections that can still be raised about details, these studies demonstrate that we aspire to the same precision that is required of other scientific foundations of medicine. The first study, published by our Biological Research Institute, is a paper on spleen function. These two lectures give me only enough time to present a few perspectives to stimulate your thinking, so please forgive me if I mention some of the issues only briefly. I became interested in spleen function in the course of my own spiritual scientific research, whose methods I will discuss shortly. Meanwhile, I will simply say that these methods allowed me to realize that spleen function, which, as you know, is a stumbling block for medical anthropology, occupies a special position among the functions of the human organs. To put it briefly, some of the many processes that contribute to the functioning of the human body promote rhythm. These processes include not only respiration and blood circulation, but also those that take place over more extended periods of time, such as the rhythm of digestion. The very nature of the human body requires that digestion be rhythmical to a degree that is not actually possible. To satisfy our body's demands, we would have to eat and drink with incredible rhythmic regularity. Since we do not eat the same foods every day, even establishing very exact meal times would not allow us to maintain the rhythm our bodies require. We would have to approach this task with infinite knowledge of the details involved. It is easier for respiration and blood circulation to function with regularity, but we really cannot meet the body's need for rhythmical digestion, because digestion depends on interaction with the outer world. Spleen function, however, unites with the total digestive process in the broadest sense to balance out and correct the unavoidable irregularities in our digestive rhythm. I became aware of this balancing function some time ago, and now it has been empirically verified in our Biological Research Institute. Although it is possible to raise some objections with regard to details of the methods that were used, these methods are, nonetheless, as precise as any other clinical methods in use today. I believe that this study, which was carried out with tremendous devotion by Dr. Lily Kalisko, would have had great impact on medical thinking if it had been conducted in a conventional clinic. That it remains relatively unknown is due exclusively to the fact that it was conducted under the auspices of anthroposophy. This last statement is the one I beg you not to attribute to foolish vanity on my part. The second study transforms a scientific and medical, in quotes, belief into exact science to the greatest extent possible. Please do not assume that I am taking sides here in the debate between homeopathy and allopathy. It would not occur to me to do so, because I know how much amateurishness the ordinary homeopathic view contains. Even materialistic physics, however, cannot deny that highly diluted substances can have far-reaching effects. We can no longer assume that highly diluted substances cannot have significant effects. Just think of the effects of inhaled substances that are present in very high dilution. When we give patients therapeutic baths, we are often unaware that the substances inhaled, along with the steam, substances that may be present in very high dilution, are much more important than the bath's external effects. Until now, such statements were simply a matter of scientific belief. We attempted to confirm this belief scientifically, within its justifiable limits, of course. The results are not to be interpreted as a universal remedy. We produced dilutions of up to 1 in 1 quintillion, so that we were certain that ordinary material effects were no longer present, and that any effects we noted were due to qualities transferred to the medium from the original substances, that is, that we were dealing with purely qualitative effects. We were able to prove that diluted quantities of a substance develop astonishing rhythm-based effects. We tested the effect of these minute quantities on the growth of very carefully selected grain seeds. The seeds were allowed to sprout in solutions of metallic compounds in different dilutions. We proved that solutions of metallic compounds in dilutions of 1 to 10, 1 to 20, 1 to 50, 1 to 100, 1 to 500, and so on, really do influence the growth forces of plants. We graphed interesting and very regular curves, demonstrating that when the enlivening force is influenced in a specific way at a particular dilution, the effect is reduced if the compound is diluted further and enhanced again at a still higher dilution. The result is a curve that alternately rises and falls as an exact expression and confirmation of the effects of minute quantities of matter. These results elevate minute quantities, some of which are misused by homeopathy, and I say this advisedly, to the ranks of suitable subjects for precise research. The purpose of this last statement is not primarily to attach greater importance to our results, but simply to show that, at least in our initial investigations, we are attempting to base our research on conventional scientific methods, rather than working outside science in some amateurish way. We will then have to take conventional research methods further. From an historical perspective, considering the tremendous successes of science in the past few centuries, especially the 19th century, it is quite understandable that humanity should have been hypnotized, as it were, by sense-based observation and exact experimentation. With regard to our knowledge of the human being, however, even on a very ordinary physical level, these methods of research cannot grasp the essence of the human body's structure and functioning. Although very great advances have been made in understanding the organization of the physical human being, the otherwise fruitful precision of these methods has excluded an entire aspect of the human being that is just as real as the physical. The success of scientific research is directly proportional to the tremendous amount of energy it has spent on excluding the human soul and spirit, which even in a medical context must be considered no less real than the physical human being. I need to explain some of the principles of anthroposophical research, especially with regard to how it leads to knowledge of the human being. It is typical of all modern research that we simply approach it as we are, with the psychological makeup, including cognitive abilities, that we acquire as a result of the conventional scientific education our culture provides. We stop short at this point. We do not consider, for example, that the attitude and soul makeup of a 2 or 3-year-old are very different from those of older people. We develop, and our psychology changes as we grow up. At age 18 or 19, we have abilities that we did not have as 2 or 3-year-olds, let alone earlier. These abilities emerge from within us. Why, then, shouldn't adults remain relatively capable of further development? Is it really acceptable to arbitrarily cut off our psychological development? The answer to these questions depends on our inner efforts, of course. But anyone who truly attempts to surpass what is now seen as the norm of human psychological development will indeed be able to acquire different soul faculties. The details can be found in my books titled How to Know Higher Worlds and titled An Outline of Esoteric Science, among others. In principle, I simply want to point out that we can indeed learn to change and enhance the form of thinking we apply not only to ordinary life, but also to experimenting and interpreting observations in conventional science. When I say this, people usually immediately interject, quote, "So now he's going to tell us about some kind of mystical development," close quote. However, anyone who disdains mystical development, if you want to call it that, should also reject mathematics and geometry. The essence of mathematics and geometry is to move with complete presence of mind, with no trace of the subconscious or of autosuggestion, from one idea to the next. This presence of mind, or complete consciousness, must follow our every move as we deal with a mathematical or geometric thought content. And the same inner precision can also be applied to our own soul development. The soul's ability to think continues to evolve, not as a result of the vagueness we often associate with mysticism, but in full clarity, not through brooding on a subject, but by beginning with very specific, clearly comprehensible mental images and proceeding just as we do in mathematics, refusing to accept any thought that interferes with moving from one conscious content to another in full presence of mind. If we apply this truly exact method of soul development long enough, for some people it takes more time, for others less, we learn to take hold of our normally passive thinking as an activity. Normally, our thoughts are passively dependent on our observations, but now we begin to experience inner activity. This inner thought activity provides our first real insight into the first level of our suprasensible existence. If we view the human body from outside and trace blood circulation in its totality, the result is a certain image or portion of the human being as viewed from outside. Similarly, by proceeding, as I have just described, with regard to our thinking, we begin to experience that the physical body is filled with a second, independent human being. Anyone who believes that auto-suggestion is involved here is not considering the exactitude of the methods I described. The whole process takes place in full consciousness, so that the soul recognizes and rejects any hint of autosuggestion. The path resulting from these methods is the exact opposite of anything hypnosis or autosuggestion can bring to consciousness. If we follow it, we find that if we apply the exact method of observation, that we have learned to the gradual process of child development, we notice a significant difference in the child's entire constitution around the time of the second dentition at age 6 or 7. The difference is subtle, and we generally disregard it. We must learn to notice it. We really must summon up the courage to observe the human being with the precision we have come to expect from modern research in physics. In physics, we speak of latent warmth as opposed to actual manifest warmth. We admit that certain processes release latent warmth from the substances that bound it. With regard to the study of soul development, we must have the courage to accept what physics has already recognized. If we have the courage such research requires, we realize that we can see, and seeing is simply a question of putting our attention to it, inner soul forces appearing in a child who has undergone the second dentition. These forces were not there earlier. Even modern child psychology has not observed closely enough to say anything about this phenomenon. The peaks and valleys on the graph are not particularly high or deep. We are dealing with subtleties that require a different spiritual type of vision. That is why this phenomenon is more or less disregarded today. To those who have acquired the vision required for spiritual research, however, it becomes evident that what we call the faculty of memory changes radically during the second dentition. Before the change of teeth, the child's memory still allows each remembered image to emerge from the organism with a certain elemental force. In contrast, the type of memory that makes us feel that we are going back to a previous experience when we remember it sets in only during the second dentition. Many other aspects of soul experience emerge only with the change of teeth, and were not evident in the child's constitution before that point. Where were they, then? They were present in the child's constitution in latent form, just as latent warmth is present in a substance. The second dentition is merely an outer symptom of the organic processes that release these faculties from the child's organism, just as physical processes release latent warmth from a substance. Modern psychology theorizes about psychophysical parallels and the like. It cannot understand the connection between an anatomical or physiological phenomenon and its own abstract conception of the soul. Seen abstractly, these two aspects of the human being seem so unrelated that we find no bridge from one to the other. But human beings develop and evolve. If we look at the contents of the human soul after the second dentition, we can say that the same forces that now appear, metamorphosed into thinking in the soul, formerly existed as organic forces at work in the growth of the child's organs. Here we have an empirical connection between the life of the soul and the life of the body. We must simply look for it at the right stage of human development. If we carry out the thought exercises I mentioned, we begin to see our own thinking as something just as strong and active, although on a soul level, as the latent thinking that is a force for growth and organization in a child's body before the second dentition. This is the second human being we discover in ourselves. On a higher level, it is not our ordinary merely passive thinking, but a second body, an etheric body, please do not take offense at the term, that imbues and organizes us. To the anthroposophical method of research, the etheric body's activity within the overall human makeup is an empirical reality, rather than something to speculate about. Naturally, I can only briefly indicate all this here. When we look at a child, we see a factor at work that we will encounter later in that person's thinking. If I want to understand the growth forces in a child or the vitalizing element in a child's body, I must turn to imaginative cognition, which transforms the perception of those forces into conscious meaning. Any healing factors present in childhood growth forces, which are later transferred to our soul life where they work passively, can be investigated only through inner vision and experience by applying the spiritual scientific method. Perceptions resulting from this method are not merely figments of the imagination, but concrete, active forces in the human organism. Thus, inner empiricism transforms superficial anthropology into true anthroposophy. Once developing our thinking in a particular way has allowed us to discover the second human being, we can also discover a third entity within the physical and etheric bodies. Please do not take offense at the name astral body. We do need a term for it, after all. There are anthroposophical reasons for the name, but at this point my purpose is only to describe the makeup of the human being. When we learn to experience the second, the etheric human being, as intrinsically independent of the physical human being, it becomes a content of our consciousness. Let me assure you that it is possible to possess this consciousness, to feel the presence of this second human being, almost as securely as we possess our physical bodies during normal waking consciousness. Much harder inner work is necessary to accomplish the next step, which requires eliminating the etheric human being from our consciousness. We can take this step only by gathering sufficient strength to suggest away the existence of the etheric human being. Having entered this being, we must very consciously leave it. As a general rule, the preliminary exercises leading to this step are not especially easy. It is difficult to eliminate mental images that we have clung to for a long time, images of such immediacy that they occupy our entire consciousness. Although with our full presence of mind, so that there is no question of autosuggestion. Such images are difficult to eliminate because they affect our consciousness much more strongly than the transient images of daily life and ordinary observation. But if we have practiced freeing our consciousness from anything it may contain, we will also be able to empty our consciousness and eliminate the content we ourselves have created. The resulting state of consciousness is exactly like waking out of ordinary dreamless sleep, but not in the body, and not in the physical world. We are outside the body, and perceive a different spiritual world around us as we wake up. You can wake up in this way by doing what I just described, emptying your consciousness again after having energized it to the greatest possible extent in order to acquire an etheric content. This empty consciousness is pure wakefulness. It contains nothing of what we otherwise experience in life or know through science. You know how difficult it is to empty your consciousness in ordinary life. Typically, when we eliminate sensory impressions, we fall asleep. The method I have described leads to empty, merely wakeful consciousness. But this consciousness does not remain empty long. It begins to receive the spiritual world, or more specifically, a third human being that is pure inner function, pure inner mobility and activity. The second etheric human being is the enlivening element, while the third astral human being is mobility and activity. The fourth human being makes it possible for us to be human in the fullest sense of the word. In the course of these lectures, I may still have an opportunity to discuss this fourth being in more detail. But for the moment, I simply want to say that it is the actual I, human, capital I. Everything I have described thus far as the physical, etheric, and astral bodies is also present in animals, but only we human beings can experience the union of these members within ourselves, in a concrete rather than an abstract way. After beginning to grasp the spiritual world by emptying our consciousness, we can achieve a complete image of the I-being by further energizing our experience of the spiritual world. These descriptions should give you an idea of the results of exact anthroposophical methods. They gradually permit us to discover the different members of the human constitution. These higher members really exist. Just as latent warmth is released and transformed into real warmth that is expressed in physical effects, the etheric body, astral body, and I are expressed in the physical human being. We understand the human being only by looking at how these four members interact. To gain an idea of this interaction, let's consider a specific detail, such as the human kidneys and their function. In every limb and organ of the human being, the four members of our human constitution work together to a greater or lesser extent. What we see when we study the kidneys by examining a corpse or making other physical observations is only the sum total of physical effects. These physical effects, however, are pervaded and energized by what I call the etheric body, specifically by the part of the etheric body that includes the vital functions of the kidneys. The etheric body, in turn, is pervaded by the astral body. Only the interaction between these members enables us to understand the makeup of the human being, even in a single organ or organ system. Let's take a case of some sort of irregular kidney function. Since you are all experts, I do not need to go into detail. When we understand the entire issue from the perspective of anthroposophical research, we realize that the irregularity causes the kidney's physical and etheric functioning to resist the astral kidney function in some way. This is a typical case. Astral kidney function, which we can perceive only when we have emptied our consciousness, is resisted by the physical and etheric organization of the kidneys. When such resistance occurs in any living organ, its astral organization must intervene much more thoroughly and energetically than it normally would, or otherwise the organ would atrophy. The result, at least in specific cases, and the cases I describe are always concrete, is an intensification of the part of the astral organization that corresponds to the kidney and its activity. In other words, astral kidney function becomes much stronger than it ought to be, and the kidney places much greater demands on the astral body than it ought to in the overall constitution of a human being. From the perspective of anthroposophical research, the astral body performs this work in the kidney by withdrawing activity from the rest of the human body. The astral process in the kidney actually should not be there. Excessive demands are being placed on the astral kidney because of specific abnormal developments in the physical and etheric kidney. At this point in the diagnostic process, we must know that the astral portion of the kidney is active in a way that is not necessary when the organism is functioning normally. In the kidney's present pathological condition, the physical or etheric kidney places extra demands on the astral component, which responds with activity that is not needed in a healthy kidney. Here, we have the first element in understanding the nature of the patient's illness. To a thinking person, disease processes should be a great riddle, because they are actually natural processes. But normal processes are also natural processes. How do the abnormal processes of disease get mixed up with normal ones? As long as we see the human being as an arbitrary network of physical substances and functions, we have no basis for distinguishing physiological phenomena from pathological ones. We can make this distinction, however, when we know that the kidney can metamorphose when physical processes develop in it that do not occur in a normal kidney, whose physical, etheric, and astral components are in harmony. This is our first insight. Now the question is, how can we combat this disease process, which is simply due to excessive demands being placed on a supersensible portion of the human constitution? How can we make the astral being function normally again? I want to keep my explanations concrete and detailed. I will not discuss serious kidney disease because the same principles are evident in milder illnesses. But simply in order to suggest how to treat such a kidney, I would like to take a specific example as my starting point. We know, to begin with, that we must relieve the astral body of its work in a kidney that has been deformed, in quotes, in the broadest possible sense. In this kidney, the human astral body is doing something it should not be doing. We must remove the astral body from this abnormal kidney process. Let's sample the results of a cognitive overview that considers the human being first and then the wider world. In the method I depicted, we shift our attention from the human being to the non-human natural world, where we study the particular character of equisitum arvensa. We are more concerned with the process that is active in it than with the individual substances it contains. Because materialistically oriented thinking is now omnipresent, in which organic matter is usually described in terms of its content of protein, fat, carbohydrates, and so on, the focus is on the individual components that superficial chemistry can tell us about. The field of chemistry has changed in recent times, and now the focus is on the so-called elements. But the elements in an organic entity are not very significant for what I have in mind. The most interesting thing to note about equisitum is the high proportion of silica that is left behind when we analyze the plant, that is, when we separate its functions. Silica is so strongly present that it predominates and expresses its function in the equisitum plant. Analysis reveals not so much the substance itself as its significance. Its significance is what we must recognize. Equisitum is a plant, so we find no astral body in it. We do find a physical body and an etheric body, however. When we study equisitum arvensa, we find that silica plays a major role in it, although of course there are other plants that contain silica, while certain sulfates play a supporting role. The most important components of equisitum, in terms of asserting their own character in the plant, are silica, not the substance but the silica function, and the activity of sulfur. Then we make a very strange discovery. When we apply spiritually developed forces to understanding what is going on in the vicinity of the sulfates that are associated with silica, SiO2, we discover a process, or a nexus of functions, that we can then introduce into the human organism, either internally or, if the situation requires, a different method of administration, through baths or injections. I will discuss the significance of these different methods later. Actually, it is better not to use equisitum as such, although the effects are visibly present in the plant itself. They are not very permanent. In our methods of preparing remedies, we first study the functional connection between silica and sulfur, for example, and then imitate it in a medical preparation. We convert the equisitum model into a more or less inorganic preparation that has stronger effects on the human organism than if we simply used the plant itself in the form of a tea or the like. This is the essential element in the production of our remedies. When this functional connection between sulfur and silica is incorporated into the human organism in the right way, it relieves the astral body in the kidney of the process it had to carry out during the illness. That is, when sulfur and silica, as they function in inquisitum arvensa, are introduced into the kidney, the human astral body is relieved of functions it would otherwise have to perform in the deformed kidney, in quotes, deformed in the broadest possible sense. For the moment, the disease process is carried out by a substitute, by a remedy that has been introduced into the body. This is the beginning of any healing process. We must be familiar with the disease process in question, and our theory of pathological conditions must be rational. We must recognize the disease process and look for places in nature where it is copied exactly. We must not simply assume that a disease process must always be combated. Instead, we need to neutralize the process, to counterbalance it with a dynamic we recognize, such as the dynamic between sulfur and silica in inquisitum, in order to free up the astral body, relieving it of functions it formerly had to perform in the diseased kidney. We must then take care to strengthen the patient internally, through diet and so on, so that his or her inner forces can be applied more energetically than usual to the entire astral body. Once we have substituted an external function for the astral body's excessively strong activity in the organ in question, the astral body, now fully normal and healthy, is able to eliminate the disease. This example demonstrates how we arrive at a rational concept of healing. As a general rule, healing involves substituting a process derived from the external world for the human disease process, and then energizing an internal force to overcome the disease, which cannot be overcome as long as the astral body is forced to apply its activity one-sidedly in an abnormal kidney, for example. What I have just described is or may be the case in any disease process that is due to irregularities in organs that work internally but centrifugally, if I may put it that way, or centrifugally, if I may put it that way. Although the kidney is an organ of elimination, it initially excretes internally. If you grasp the principle I have described, you will understand that this pathological kidney process is healed by stimulating a centrifugal or outwardly radiating process in the kidney by administering inquisitum arvensa. Other disease processes demonstrate the polar opposite of what I have just described. Once again, I will not use the example of a serious illness to introduce the general principle, but rather one that, although it is extremely unpleasant for the patient, attracts relatively little attention compared with deeper-seated illnesses. This disease is hay fever, or allergic rhinitis. In attempting to combat hay fever, we must realize that we are dealing with a fundamental constitutional disorder based on a peripheral reduction in the forces of the third, inwardly mobile member of the human being, the astral body. The origin of hay fever can be traced back to childhood, when generalized and generally disregarded disorders appear that then become specialized, appearing later in life as hay fever. If we know that hay fever involves a decline in certain astral functions that prevent the astral body from reaching the physical and etheric bodies, our first concern must be to energize the astral body internally and redirect it to what it should be doing. In a pathological condition such as hay fever, more externally directed centrifugal effects are apparent and must be actively counteracted. In kidney disease, we counterbalanced or offset the illness. We saw that the astral body simply needed to be freed from its abnormal work in the diseased kidney and then energized and strengthened in order to work in the direction of health. This is not true of processes such as hay fever. In such cases, we cannot begin by offsetting the disease process. Instead, it must be counteracted by a comparable process working in the opposite direction. We have found that the activity an astral body has stopped performing because it no longer has access to the physical and etheric bodies can be restored by using the juices of certain fruits. The fruit must have rinds, and centripetal effects must be evident within the fruit itself. A preparation made from the juices of such fruits is administered in ointment form in milder cases, or as injections in more severe cases. We have already experienced considerable success with this treatment, which drives the astral body back into the physical and etheric bodies. Dr. Wegmann has successfully treated many patients with our injectable hay fever remedy. Our way of thinking does indeed yield ways of energizing a sluggish astral body. Depending on the specific fruit that is chosen, the processes these injections stimulate have an affinity for particular organs. We need to investigate which organs are affected and what tendencies reveal the affinities. The injection-induced processes demonstrate that physical symptoms due to a sluggish astral body can indeed be corrected by offsetting the astral body itself. In the previous example, we neutralized the disease process, but in this case, we counterbalance a process in the area we hope to affect. In choosing a treatment, we must distinguish between centrifugal therapeutic processes, such as those I described for the kidneys, and centripetal processes, as in our hay fever remedy, for example. On first consideration, such remedies may seem to have been dreamt up out of nothing, and in fact that is what most of our contemporaries will believe. Consequently, I have placed great emphasis not only on the need to produce such remedies, but also on the need to implement our own school of medical thought in our institutes. Confirming the efficacy of our remedies, however, is not the same as testing remedies developed through empirical methods applied on the physical level. In the latter case, we depend heavily on statistics, which tell us whether the remedy is helpful in a high proportion of cases. If we begin by applying a method such as the one I have discussed here, however, our clear understanding of a specific disease process reveals the cure. So diagnosis and treatment become one and the same thing. The situation is this. If diagnosis reveals what is going on in a diseased kidney, the process that must be applied therapeutically is the same, but on a different level. For example, the disease process may be counterbalanced by giving the patient a combination of sulfur and silica as a substitute for the particular pathological process I have recognized. A cure is accomplished through a treatment implemented by the astral body that imitates the disease process on a different level. For example, if I introduce the equisetum function into the human organism, it stays in the etheric body, and the astral body is relieved of its work in the diseased kidney. Thus, diagnosis and treatment, which exist in parallel today and can come together only on a purely empirical basis, become a unity. In recognizing the nature of a disease process in this way, we discover, for example, that equisetum arvensa imitates a specific kidney process. If we recognize that the inner character of gall excretion in certain illnesses is the same as the process we find in Sicorium intubus, the plant process shows us how to relieve the astral body of the gall-excreting function it would otherwise have to perform in the liver. We make advances in healing when diagnosis is no different from treatment, while treatment becomes a truly rational science. For example, if we are aware of the wonderful connection between iron and certain salts and components of plant mucilage in Anisum vulgara, we can also recognize that one of the functional elements in anise, and especially in its seed, is the same as certain hyper-inflammatory disease processes in the blood. Footnote, Pimpinella anisum is the current botanical name for anise. End of footnote. We can relieve the blood of these disease processes by using an appropriately produced preparation that imitates the relationship between plant mucilages and iron in anise. When we treat disorders in the blood, we do not simply free up the astral body. The eye organization is involved as well. We can look at the entire natural world in this way. The beautiful natural world we see consists entirely of imitations of disease processes. Inside the human being, these processes are disease processes. Outside the human being, they are the beauties of nature. We must simply understand the individual connections. We must know how to derive disease processes from the natural world and incorporate them into the human being as substitutes, freeing up the supersensible members that have been carrying out disease processes in the body. Now, we no longer depend on statistics. Inner perceptions that allow us to clearly understand and predict the effects of specific connections between the human being and the natural world are comparable to a precisely scientific and properly executed physics experiment. In physics, too, we do not proceed according to statistics, because we know, parenthesis, with regard to the Mariette-Gray-Lussac law, for example, that an experiment that is precisely carried out is conclusive, although the situation with respect to human beings is admittedly not as simple as a physics experiment, we can nonetheless predict how a remedy will work, and then actually see how it works, if we have clearly understood the disease process. Our method of developing remedies requires an attitude that has been achieved to a very great extent by Dr. Wegmann at the Clinical Therapeutic Institute in Arlesheim. This attitude bans all skepticism, a major obstacle to progress in medicine. The quality that Dr. Wegmann possesses above all else is the all-important courage to heal. When we have the courage to heal, we will also be able to see and understand disease processes and begin to counteract them. We must not be sloppy in our work. It is especially important to note exactly how the healing process takes place, and to monitor it from step to step. If we do this, we will notice when something is not as it should be, and we will be able to retrace our steps and discover what we may have overlooked. When we have the courage to heal in each single case, when our only assumption and intention is that healing will take place, we possess the strongest possible incentive, namely, a truly scientific foundation for medicine. Rational treatments are not worked out as mere consequences of exact diagnosis, but are discovered in the diagnostic process itself. Treatment is available as soon as the diagnosis is made. Thus, we describe a kidney ailment as very similar to what happens in Equisetum arvensa. We transfer what we see in the kidney to an outer process in nature, and our diagnostic descriptions themselves include the therapeutic process. The end of Lecture 5.